As I said, my name is Gene, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gene.
Just briefly tell you, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I moved down here to Florida in 20 years ago. Through all that, it's been geographical changes, you know, but no matter where I went, there I was. You know, nothing changes. And been around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous probably since somewhere around 1976-77. And I finally got sober on June 4th of 2009, right here at Central. I walked in here with my head between my legs, scared to death, not wanting to live, but not wanting to die. You know, and since I've been in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, all I can tell you is things happened that I'm not even going to say are beyond my wildest dreams, because I let go of those dreams, but then they happened, you know. Since I've been sober, I've also had to be incarcerated to clean up the wreckage of my past, you know, troubles of my own making, as somebody reminds me, and, you know, and then, but I keep pressing on, and when I got out, I continued to come here to Central. I picked up a sponsor, continued my steps. I had great support. So I do know when things do go wrong, there are people I can depend on. I have friends today. People invite me to their homes today. And I never had that before, you know. The last two Christmases that I've had have been absolutely incredible. I've spent them at somebody's house that has a little gathering every year. And it's probably the first time in my life I could ever remember spending or celebrating those holidays. So I don't want to get into much to my growing up, but, you know, it wasn't very good. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. Now, you know, it's great to be up here for a Saturday night speaker meeting. It's, wow, look at all these beautiful people, you know, and it is an honor to introduce this gentleman that I asked to speak. He'd known me for quite a few years, and actually he was my sponsor about 10 years ago when I was coming around here and trying to do this deal. And, you know, I come back and he's still here today, you know, amazing. You know, because sometimes I look at people and they say they got 10, 12, 15 years sober. I'm like, yeah, you're right, you're full of shit. You know, but it's a proven fact. And then when I sit here and look at myself at almost 2.5 years sober, one day at a time, and put one foot in front of the other no matter what happens, you know, I find it hard to believe that I'm even sober 2.5 years. So, you know, this gentleman, I heard him speak about 2 years ago at a gratitude dinner, but it is, I'm just going to tell you, as I said last week, I have mentors in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous today. I have people that I use as my strong support group, and then I have people that I look up to, and I talk to, and I say hello to, and I listen to when they share. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce David C.
Thank you. I'm David, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 23rd, 2001. That means I'm full of it. And, I know less today than I did when I came in here first. In the summer of 1987, when I was first making my start at AA. Gene, thanks for the invitation. It is a pleasure to see you up here. From knowing a little bit about your story, you really are somebody who shouldn't drink. Gene is a good example of what happens when you're willing to go to any length to get sober. And also what happens when you're not willing to go to any length to get sober. And that's you're one of my mentors. And I really appreciate the work that you put in. And the thing that helps me to stay around is seeing the miracle work in others. It makes me believe that it can happen to me, and it can happen to you as well. So thanks. And thanks, of course, to Central Orlando Group for having this meeting. Central's been my home group since on and off and on again since 1987. And it has really been a home group. As a matter of fact, I sit in that very chair at noon usually on the weekday meetings. I live in Mount Dora, but I work downtown. I used to live downtown, but this has been a constant part of my it's a constant part of my life and my day. And sitting in that chair and looking out is just like being at a noon meeting. So it's good to be home. I'd like to also thank my sponsor for leading me through to the point where I found a connection with a power greater than myself. And I also want to thank the guys that I've had the privilege of working with for teaching me so much about myself. And I want to also thank my wife and for our loved ones that have hung in there with us who are not in this program but have seen us go through hell and have hung in there and have been a part of my recovery. So, all that said, my story is kind of a fractured one. It's got a couple different bends and turns and a twist, but as Heidi said last week when she was talking, your story is your sobriety, and my story is my sobriety. I don't know how flashy it is. I don't know how impressive it is, but I know it's my story, and it's what I know about the disease of alcoholism and how much I desperately need this program and how grateful I am to be a part of it today. I was raised in the North. I was born in Pittsburgh. My dad was a minister. We moved around a lot. We settled in the Chicago area and suburbs around there. My first drink of alcohol was when I was about 11 years old or 12. I was watching my sister's dog when she was down south on vacation with my mother and my younger brother. And stopped playing with it one day and the dog got run over. So I'm sitting on the porch of our house with this dead dog in my lap, just crying my entire lousy childhood out. And I was at that deepest pit of despair. Everything was just, that was a jumping off point, and I was 12 years old. And my dad came out and got the dog out of my arms and came back with a glass of wine, and he handed it to me and had me drink it. And then he had me drink another glass of wine. And the transformation from the pit of that despair to swinging from the chandeliers was amazing. I mean, it was a total transformation. It was a 180. And for me, it was, here is a feel-good to put on a feel-bad. And that was the first message that I got from alcohol. And the effect was electric. I didn't go back to drinking right away. But that was an underlying thing, and I couldn't wait till I was going to be able to join the fraternity of drinkers when I got a little bit older. And it wasn't that much longer. When I was in high school, I converted into faith and was for a while very much a part of the evangelical faith. But God didn't deliver on the things that I wanted God to deliver. And my family didn't stay together. Family broke up. And I kind of threw out the baby Jesus with the bathwater. I just said, to heck with it. I'm going to go my own way. And by the time I was 16 years old, I was drinking daily. My dad and I would have scotch together on the back porch and at night. And I got in the habit of drinking regularly. And when the family broke up, my older brother and myself and my dad started drinking like fish on the summer before I went to college. And I took that drinking habit with me when I went off to school in Washington State. And I was a solitary drinker, a lone wolf. I didn't drink would get me out of myself, but the job that it needed to do was just to cover over that feel bad inside of me. And I didn't do much socializing with people for the first few years when I was in college. I just stayed down in my room and studied and drank. And so I was in real trouble by the time I was about 18 years old, but there wasn't any help for it. I went through some suicidal periods, and finally I dropped out of school and I started playing in rock and roll bands. The only way that I could get the kind of level of approval that I felt I needed was to be revered, you know? That was the only way you could feel normal, was to be playing a guitar with the amp cracked up to 10 past 10, and making as much noise as possible and living large. And my drinking took off with that. I discovered other substances. They usually were in dresses. So I can say I'm dual addicted. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so we will keep to the topic of alcoholism. I moved down to Florida from Washington State in 1980, got a job at the local newspaper, and my drinking got into, I started doing bar drinking then, going out and getting into 5-6 nights a week of drinking. I was drank too much to be much good as a musician, so I was in a series of very bad garage bands that didn't last for too long, though we did a lot of partying together. So that kind of fizzled out on me. And by 1986 or so, I was doing 6-7 nights of drinking, blackouts, and just sliding off. And I decided I was going to try to quit one summer after a band broke up, and it lasted for about 2 weeks. I found that if you just put the plug in the jug and you stop drinking, life becomes really crazy. And I didn't know what to do with my time. I would sit there in my apartment, hands folded, apartment completely clean, not a drink in sight, and nothing to do. I didn't know how to fill up that huge space that I had filled with drinking. So soon enough, I was back out again and was going off the deep end. And somewhere in the midst of that, this was the winter of 1986, I had a dream that I was walking out in a cold, kind of like a Siberian type of place. It was freezing winter, and it was snow everywhere, and it was night, and there were wolves all around. It was the absolute most alien place. I might as well have been on the moon. And I saw in the distance a farmhouse, and I walked up to the window and I peered in. Inside I saw a man and a woman, and the woman was holding a baby, and they were next to the fire. And I looked in there and I thought, I can't go in. I don't belong there. And I had to turn around and walk back off into the night. And that was where I was with my drinking. In the spring of 1987, I got a DUI, and as a result of a nudge from the judge, I had my 3 meetings a week that I had to come to someplace, and I was working around the corner at the newspaper, and this place was close by, and I started coming to Central. And in my first AA meeting, I didn't know what to expect. And, you know, I don't know why. You know, this is the thing about my alcoholism, is just this black hole that's right in the middle of everything, that the most obvious things about myself I'm blind to. And I just thought I was a nice guy with a lot of bad luck and a little drinking problem. And it just never occurred to me that all this insanity was coming from my drinking. As I sat in that AA meeting and I heard you guys sharing, I hear you guys talk about things that I wouldn't have confessed to another soul, about things inside, the despair, the loneliness, the crazy things I did in blackouts. And I began to hear pieces of my story going around, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not so alone in this as I thought. And I liked it. And after I got to the end of my period of time when I had to get my 3 signatures a week, I kept coming. But I have to say, in my first journey into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was ready so far. I wanted finally to get off the bar stool and have a life. I wanted a job, a real job. I wanted to get into a relationship finally. All I'd had up until the age of 30 were one-night stands. I wanted all that stuff I couldn't get when I was drinking. And to me, that's what sobriety meant, was getting all those things. And at the third AA or fourth AA meeting, I met my future wife. We married before we got sponsors, or did started working the steps. That was convenient. A wonderful gal. We made a lot of meetings here at Central together. with all that untreated alcoholism and jumping into something like that as another one of those cures, it was hell. And I had my issues, she had her issues, and it was like sniper fire. We didn't know whose were what and what was coming in for wherever. It was real insanity. And so, but you know, I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor who I thought was like my dad, or who could be my dad. Which is not really what a sponsor is for. He was going to help me learn how to be a good parent and manage my finances and all those things. And we worked the steps, but I don't think I was listening. You know, I think all the information was being said in these rooms. I just wasn't really listening. And my foundation that got laid down was pretty brittle. I had kind of an a la carte approach to doing the steps. I liked the concept of it, I didn't mind doing it, but I wasn't going to let God get into other parts of my life, take care of my drinking, but, you know, leave my lust to me. I did a little bit of service work, but then after a few years I thought, well, let the newcomers do that. I've kind of done my work, let's pass that on to the younger generation. I think I might have been 4 years sober at the time. There was an opportunity to work once with this guy who was just desperate, and my wife really wanted me to get to working with him, and I said, you work your program, I'll work mine. And I refused to do it, and I think that was a turning point. I think when I decided to, in the sixth step, it talks about the difference between a self-determined objective and the perfect objective, which is of God, which means me deciding how sober I'm supposed to be versus this practice of continuing to surrender to spiritual growth and going having the opportunity to stay sober for the rest of your life. So anyway, there were faults in my foundation, and my wife and I we ended up divorcing, and after about a year later than that, I started feeling like I had done enough in AA. I was 7 years sober. I started going out to some bars and drinking near beer. I'm not drinking, I'm just out to be. And it was like, I'm just so close I can get to the edge without falling over. That seemed to be the thirst, slowly reeling me in. And I wasn't going to listen to anybody else's advice. I wasn't talking with my sponsor. I was only making a couple of meetings a week. I wasn't working with anybody. I wasn't doing any more than saying the quickest prayers, and I just had stopped growing. And my thought was, a guy like me deserves to have a little bit of fun, don't you think? I've worked hard. I'm just overly responsible. And these things just slowly set me up. So it was, you know, maybe 8 months of near beers at bars, standing there, and it is like... it's kind of like making love to an inflatable doll, you know? I mean, they say, you know, we can't control and enjoy our drinking. Trying to control it to that degree was miserable. So anyway, on my 8th sober anniversary, my fiance for my future wife, we were at my brother's wedding. And they had a line for wine and a line for near wine. And I was in the near wine line. I was being a good boy. And I walked up there and I got my near wine. And of course, you know, my alcohol radar immediately goes off. Bing! This is it. This is booze. And I didn't spit it out. My first thought was, I can do this thing. I can do this thing. Guy like me who's been in AA, who's learned all this stuff, ought to know something about drinking by now, don't you think? I didn't take us on any advisement other than my own thinking. And as it says, an alcoholic alone or in their own head is in enemy country, territory. And I was certainly prey to that. And I set myself up, starting just having a couple of drinks a week, maybe, you know, a cocktail with this and all that. And it wasn't maybe 2 months, 3 months later, and I was drinking like a fish. Drinking like it never was. And where I used to be a bar drinker, I was now a settled suburbanite, hide the bottle anywhere you can in the house drinker. I had the official scotch bottle underneath the cabinet in the kitchen. I was supposed to have one scotch a day. My wife felt that was okay. A guy like me who's been around should know that this is my next wife who had no exposure to AA, so she didn't know. And she felt like one drink a day would be fine. And I said, fine. And I'd have the drink there, and she'd go upstairs and do something, and I would just continually refill that sucker. And I had an extra scotch bottle hidden in the closet, so you know the official bottle never got down that far too fast. And this was crazy. And my goal was, in the insanity of going back to drinking, was, is I'm going to see how far off I can do this thing and get away with it. And this went on for 6 years. And in the course of that, within maybe 2 months after I started really drinking heavily, I'd just gotten married. We'd just gotten a house in Mount Dora. I'm starting to have affairs. I'm starting to hide drinks. I'm hiding bottles. I am carrying on all kinds. The closet in which I lived, that my secret life was hidden, there in the house of my new love, my new life, was just rotting at the core. And so this went on for a while. And then, you know, I think I came home in a blackout one night, and my wife got so angry at me because I wasn't even supposed to be drinking. You know, how can you get so drunk on one drink? And there were a lot of movies that we'd watch at night that I had no idea how they ended. And when she, you know, I'd come back from the video store, and she said, "We just watched that this last week." I was having my one drink. But anyway, I did say finally, you know, okay, fine. I'll just drink a beer a day. And I did that for a year and a half. I drank a beer a day. And for people who are not alcoholics, maybe that's not really a big deal. But when I say that an alcoholic can't control and enjoy their drinking, to have just one beer is to get just a whisper of that little cloud starting to descend, which says, if you have another one, you're going to start having fun. But no, I'm being a good boy. And so it was a miserable year and a half. And so eventually I was back off to the races again. I think I was in another affair at the time. And my wife found out about Mrs. Wrong. And I just decided that I didn't need to have the interference anymore, and I wanted to be able to drink with impunity. And I just got an offer from the credit card company that wanted to extend my credit limit to $18,000, and I thought I could have a lot of fun with this. So I left my wife. I moved in with my mother, a 42-year-old man living with his mother, driving over to the dollhouse and dropping $300 a night in the tight little dresses of the gals that were working there. And I was cheating on the woman that I'd left my wife for. And then I ended up cheating on her. And this only lasted 6 months. I drank through $15,000 of credit card in 6 months, and it was almost all bar tabs. You know, it's like, how many $10 martinis can you slosh a night? And so anyway, you know, I'm separated from my wife. She's quite happy to get ready to divorce me. I'm staying at my mother's house. And I'm at the point of where I'm praying again, but it's like, God, take me in a way that my wife will get the insurance money. It got to the point to where I couldn't see more than a week or two ahead, and then it was dark. And in the summer of 2001, my wife and I had a talk, and we're going over the details of the divorce. And she looked at we had been working. I was coming up and doing yard work, and we were sitting on the back porch, and it was raining. And she says, "You know, I just don't want to lose this thing. We worked so hard for it." And I realized that I didn't want to lose it either. And so there was a shred of something that said that I want to return. I want to come back to life. I'd been seeing a shrink. He finally told me he wasn't going to work with me anymore until I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. One night I was out drinking and went into a blackout, and I came to, and my car was in the middle of the road with two flat tires and a lost clutch and smoke coming out of the hood, and I had no idea what had happened. To this day, I have no idea of what happened. I just pushed the car to the side of the road, walked the mile and a half back to my mother's place, and the next day I woke up and I realized that this thing was over. Just the next day, I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a Thursday afternoon, 6 o'clock meeting. I'd been gone for 6 years. I walked in through that door, and my first feeling when I walked in, I got flooded with it. I'm home. And I thought, what is it that kept me from the thing where I had known the most happiness in my life? And that was simple. It was my own alcoholism. That thing inside of me that is forever in love with whiskey. I'll always love booze. There's part of me, there's a dark part of me that will always love booze. The only thing that I can do is to put myself in a place where I'm safe and where I'm growing. And I can't do it alone. And for me, that was getting into here into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And as I walked in, there was a guy sitting there at the table, Tom, he was gone now. He was an old-timer who I remember from the years back. The only thing that had really changed at AA were the chairs. Everything else was the same. A lot of the guys were still around. And he said, "How you been? Haven't seen you in a while." He didn't know. And I said, "I haven't been very well." And so began my process of getting back into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that is said, half of me wanted to get sober. And then there was another half of me that just wanted to still, so I was very divided. And something had to change. Something had to grow. Something had to change. Something had to be transformed inside of me or I was going to drink again. A couple weeks later, September 11th, I was supposed to fly out to a convention the next day, and all that got canceled, and I came to a noon meeting here. It was one of the best meetings I'd ever been in. And there was people in the room who had not been able to get a hold of family members that were working in the tower that day. And we ended that meeting saying the 11th step prayer, which said something very clearly about putting a feel-good on a feel-bad, which is what we do with our love and service to the world. I got a sponsor. I wasn't going to waste any time in getting back into this thing, and I didn't know who to pick for a sponsor, but I said, "God, I'm just going to trust you that the person I talk with next is going to be my sponsor." Guy came up after the meeting, handed me his phone number, said, "Tag, you're it." He had a year more sobriety than I did, and we worked this time together. He got me right onto the steps, and maybe about another month later, I was still white-knuckling it, still trying to get used to being back in this thing, and I had one of those days where it just didn't seem like it was going to work, and I came to 4 meetings on a Friday, since 6:30 noon, 6, and I was waiting for the 8 o'clock meeting. And I talked to people and said, "Man, I'm really thinking about drinking," and you know, I was doing all that, and nothing was working. And I said, "Well, okay, if I still feel like this way after the meeting, this meeting, I'll just head back to, you know, the club, and that's it." And as I sat down for the 8 o'clock meeting, this guy next to me said, "You know, this is my third meeting. I've never been here, been to this meeting. And I don't really understand what we're doing here or this format or something like that." And we started talking a little bit. And then the meeting started. And then after the meeting was over, we talked out in the parking lot. We had one of those half-hour conversations that were out there, you know, after everybody's left and you're the only one standing around still. And I gave him a phone number, and he left. And I realized that the compulsion to drink was gone. And the thing that saved me was that reaching out. That person saved my life that night. I have no doubt that if I had gone back to drinking, I would not have survived, and I would not be here. I would not have made my way back again. So, very, very important lesson in that. A few weeks later from there, we're saying in a meeting, and a woman was sharing about how her husband was divorcing her for all the things that she had done, and that she was just praying that her husband would be okay. And my wife was still not sure at all about me. I was still living with my mother. Something in me broke. And I started crying a little bit. And we were saying the Our Father. And as we were saying the Our Father, this thing came to me. It occurred to me. A little voice said, "No, as long as you keep yourself united in this circle, everything will be okay." And it was a certainty. It was a certainty that if I stayed close to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it would be all right. And there was no promise that it was like I was going to get my wife back. There was no promise that people weren't going to die. There was no promise that I was going to get anything that I wanted. It wasn't that kind of a thing like, be a good boy and we'll get you back all the things you want. It was just simply saying, the solutions for living life on an everyday basis are here, and if I stay close, that I have a chance at this happy, joyous, and free vision that you guys talk about. And that was my spiritual revelation. That was, I think, one of my spiritual awakenings. And we talk about spiritual awakenings coming as a result of the steps. But it isn't just the spiritual awakening, I think, that's important. It's the willingness to continue to grow. And so a lot of what came for me in the years to come from there was just being willing to go to any length to get sober. And I know that I'm a pretty deceptive guy, and I can fool myself really, really easily. And it takes every tool in the toolbox for me to be able to stay sober. So that meant working the steps. It meant having a sponsor that I stayed transparent with, who knew me, and somebody who I couldn't lie to, because I can lie to people real easily. And so this is somebody who I have that 100% transparency with. And then I got sponsors. I got guys that I work with that I have to turn around and give this thing back. And the thing about sponsees is that you can't ask a sponsee to do something that you're not going to do yourself. So it helps me to a level of accountability that I wouldn't otherwise have. Knowing that I've got a home group. Noon Central is my home group here at Central. And I know that those people that are in that meeting know me. And I didn't even have dreams where I would be drinking or be wanting to drink or something. And I say, well, do I have to pick up a chip at Central tomorrow? And it was getting into my psyche that I knew that if I had a meeting to go to, that there was going to be, that was going to hold me accountable. And then I was going to have to find this power greater than myself. And it's been a slow road for me. You know, I'm not... I thought maybe because my dad was a minister, I had, you know, I was be grandfathered into the work part of it, and I just would naturally have a sense of it, but it didn't work out that way. And Bill Wilson talks about that icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow he had shivered for so many years, and boy, I understood that. I had put a huge wedge between me and the world through that big noodle of mine, and I had to surrender that. I had to get out of that, and that meant surrender. And it didn't mean just surrender in saying your third step prayer. It meant surrender every day, and it meant continuing to surrender, and it meant continuing to grow. I remember reading once that scientists had discovered that spiders, at one point in their evolution, spiders used to make webs all over, just they did everything all over the place. And then finally a spider figured out how to make a circular web. This is because I guess they had fossil remnants or something like that. But once they figured out how to make that circular web, it was the perfect trap. I mean, it was the perfect device for catching food. You get into apparently, I don't know why, but you're in there and you just don't get out. And to me, there's a lot about, I don't know what on any given day is going to save me. I don't know if it's going to be saying my third step prayer or my seventh step prayer. I don't know if it's going to be the conversation I have with my sponsor or with a sponsee or something that somebody says in a meeting. I don't know where it's going to come from, but I know that if I have all those things as a part of the whole for me, that that's where the sense of serenity and of purpose and of feeling like this thing's lasting, this thing's going to last. I don't know. You know, I've been in and out of the rooms before, so I can know I can't. It's really not in my hands, other than to the degree to which I continue to stay surrendered. And boy, stuff comes along. You know, alcoholism is a really devious illness. If you've heard the statistics, about 90 to 95% of alcoholics die drunk. That's like having that's like some forms of cancer. I mean, have a better survival rate than that. I heard one speaker say once, why? What, from all the experience of working with alcoholics, what is the thing that kills alcoholics more than others? You understand? You don't understand. It's different for me. My uniqueness, my sense of apartness, my sense is that I only have to do this thing so much. I don't need you guys. My sense of going, cutting myself off, it hasn't been a straight road for me when I've come back. I've gone. I've blundered. I've played around on the edges of things. I've decided maybe I can toy with this a little bit, or maybe this is something that I don't need to have God involved in. And all I know is it takes just a little bit of space, just a little bit of a closet to be hidden or be lying about or to be hiding something, and the disease is starting to put thirst back in me. And maybe that thirst doesn't take the form of thirst initially. Maybe it's peeking into the Swedish bikini team's locker room on the internet. Or maybe it's, you know, maybe it's something else that's going to alter my mood a little bit, you know. Anything that gets, if I find that sobriety is intolerable, the feelings of sobriety are intolerable, such that I have to fix it, then I know the drink has got me. And there's a lot of alcoholics that may never drink again, but they'll put a gun in their mouth because they get that intolerable feeling of alcoholism. And I've had the experience of several sponsees that have committed suicide because they couldn't stand the feeling of intolerable sobriety. And if you've ever been in a meeting where we talk about losing people, people that were here and that are not here anymore, or people who never made it, talk about fathers or mothers or sisters or friends or wives, or this is a devastating disease, and this thing runs through some families. It's a miracle that some people in these rooms have survived the things that they have gotten through, as thick as the alcoholism is. And it's a deadly disease. I just know that I have to not let alcoholism get a hold on me. And for me, that means staying safe in the middle. I started at one point knowing that it was really important to do my seven-step prayer, where I gave God everything. Again, being willing to go to any length to get sober. But trying to find a place to do that, I was trying to work it into my day, and I started doing it on the beginning of my commute to work, because I have about an hour's commute in from Mount Dora every day. And my character defects often display themselves quite readily on the road commuting. So that was a pretty smart place to start it from. But it's been, these are things that you start something and something will start to grow, you know. As I've been practicing that now for, I don't know, maybe the last 5 years or so, that prayer has grown and changed. You know, when I say to, I would that you would have all of me, the good and the bad, the reason that it's important to say the good and the bad is because I'm not really sure which is going to get me. I'm not really sure. I got a pretty back-assward brain, so what I think are most important things in my life may not be that important, and what I think are such virtues may not be that great. So it really is hedging my bets to turn all those things over. And then, I make a little list of the things that I'm struggling with, it's take away my vanity, take away my lust, take away my self-centeredness, I give you my loneliness, I give you my despair over our finances, I give you my marriage, I give you my job. And then at the end of that I say, make me into the person you would have me become. And the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's a guided path. That's the wonderful thing about this thing. The early founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, through very difficult experience, figured out a guided path, a way out, through the steps and through the traditions. And so there is this promise that if you get on that path, that you can trust that everything will be okay. Once I was sitting in a meeting and I was just looking up at the sky and just despairing over something, and this person next to me whispered, "Everything's going to be okay. You're all right." You never know when help is going to come. You don't know where it's going to come from in this meeting, but if I'm in a meeting, I got a good chance of hearing that message. So, anyway, the great thing is that out of the product of this thing, one of the things that I've learned on this time around, at least, is that it's not my sobriety. I don't own it. How much time I've got here doesn't really mean that much. Sobriety is by the grace of my God. If I think that I own it, then I take responsibility for it, and then I'm starting to manage it, and then I no longer need God. Thanks, God, but I no longer need you. I'm doing fine. And I know where that takes me. Gosh, you know, I heard somebody say in a meeting once, Alcoholics Anonymous is like a bottomless reservoir. The possibilities are endless. And I see that by listening to everybody's stories and how it evolves and changes. People that have come from very, very desperate places go on getting to things that would have been unimaginable. Reuniting with families. Becoming employable. Finding a way of being serene and happy without that being dependent upon circumstances. You know, it's not what's going on out there. It has everything to do with my relationship with my higher power and my acceptance of that. And I'm real grateful that this program is here. I'm grateful for my sponsor for helping to point me towards a higher power. I'm real grateful for my higher power. I want to thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you.